And I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Ted Flicker. He is a former filmmaker. He's currently a sculptor, and his sculptures are in a group show at Wade Wilson Art at 409 Canyon Road here in Santa Fe, where there will be a reception tonight from 5 to 7. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, my darling Charlotte.
So we've had you on the air before talking about films and your Hollywood career and your stage career, and you moved to Santa Fe 30 years ago or so and started, basically gave up Hollywood and theater and all of that for good and started doing sculpture.
Yeah.
And how did you choose that medium, or that medium choose you?
I've always, you know, when I was a little kid in the 40s, I used to go down the cellar and make puppets out of paper mache. I remember doing Tojo Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin. Over the years, I always fiddled with my hands in something like that. And then, when I was 65, I had just come off a book tour, and I was going to start another novel, and I said, oh, wait. Before I do that, I've always wanted to learn about sculpture. And somebody introduced me to Paul Moore, a great sculptor whose studio then was downtown. And I went to him and I said, hey, would you teach me? He said, sure, come on tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I get to his studio and he's starting a portrait of some Olympic decathlon winner. And as he works, he keeps showing me what he's doing with the tools and why. And after about an hour, he said, so do you want to do more? I said, yeah, I want to do this. He said, good. We went to Artisans, and we got the sculpture table and the clay and the tools, and we came back to my place, and he handed me a plaster portrait that he had done. He said, copy this. I'll see you Friday. I said, wait. We haven't talked about how much you're going to charge for this. He said, oh, I don't charge. He said, you got to give something back. I said, wait, I've seen how you live. You're the proverbial church mouse, and I'm a rich man. Let me pay you. He said, I can't do that. He said, if I charged you, I'd have to charge the others, and they can't afford it. And I said, oh, this guy is going to be my friend. And today, all these years later, we're best friends. And he's a hugely successful sculptor. And from the moment I started that portrait in what is now my studio, then it was a woodworking shop, I have never written a word.
Is that right?
I'm in my studio every morning at 8 o'clock, and I work till noon. I used to work later, but now I'm old.
And so you started, I mean, you did always working with the figure, always working mostly with the human figure, portraits of people you knew, many portraits of your wife, and a lot of them had a kind of wonderful sense of humor and bringing in elements, sometimes mythological elements or some kind of storytelling elements that in some ways gave one the sense of the personality of that person whom you were sculpting.
Right. I mean, don't forget, my previous two careers in the theater and films, I did a lot of comedy, a lot of political satire. And now I started doing portraits of the artists we collect. I've got about a dozen and a half and 20 more to go. I should live so long.
You're doing every artist whose work you have represented in your own art collection, you're making a portrait of that artist?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm in discussions now to have a bunch of those Santa Fe artist portraits in the Fine Arts Museum in the courtyard.
Ah, very interesting. So this was something that you decided to do basically for fun, not this is a second career where you're going to make a living at it.
Well, it's not for fun is just a little too easy.
Right, okay.
I take art very seriously, and I've been in it now for 64 years. And art is about truth. And just because I do comedy doesn't mean I don't do very serious truth. That's what political satire is. And I chose, for instance, to do my artists as mythological creatures based on their gestalt, who they are. And it's fun. And it is perhaps the most profoundly satisfying creative work I've done in my whole life.
Does their response, the people whom you are sculpting, does that play a role for how you do your work? In other words, are you looking for something in particular from them? Do you care how they respond?
So far I only do artists we collect. Therefore, I know them well. I understand who they are deeply because I want that painting or that sculpture that artist did, and I want it because it moves me. They move me. And Santa Fe's paradise for culture, for artists. Every one of the artists we know are so generous to me with their time, their advice. That wouldn't happen in Hollywood, I assure you.
Right. So when they see these portraits of themselves, do they say, yep, you got me, or I can't believe you did that, or what kind of response
do
you got?
Some do. When I did Dan Dominga, he and his whole family, they only travel in a pack. You never see less than 7 or 8 Domingas at once. They all came to look at it, and they didn't say a word. I was devastated. And then last year, Arlo, his son, also a sculptor, was over experimenting with something I'm working with. I'm working in a new material, a contemporary material called polymer, and it lives outside like bronze. Anyhow, he wanted to see about it. We were looking at Dan's portrait, and he said, "Boy, that's good." I said, "Yeah, does Dan like it?" Because I give them each a copy. He said he loves it. He looks at it all the time. I said, why didn't he tell me? You know? And I know why he didn't tell me, because he's an Indian. They don't talk a lot.
We're talking to Ted Flicker. Now, at a certain point, you started doing interpretations of biblical stories, Old Testament stories.
Yeah. For the first part of my new career in sculpture, I didn't want to sell anything. So I didn't want a gallery. I just didn't want to look up from my work in the studio and see 2 suits standing there and say, put bigger boobs on her. No, I just decided not to sell it. And now I am. And I am because I'm 82. That's a heads-up number. I began thinking about all my heirs, all my beloved nephews and nieces and grandnephews and nieces wandering around that 4 acres of sculpture we got saying, what the hell are we going to do with all this bronze? And I was telling this to Lou Pollock, who's a local major art collector, very knowledgeable in art. He said, Ted, you have to establish prices or you'll leave them nothing. So I agreed to sell it, and then God was good to me, and Wade Wilson showed up, and he's terrific. He's going to do it.
So you're doing this religious-based art.
That's my voice. For all those beginning years when I wasn't selling it, I was learning how to do it. I was learning technique. And with that technique, I found my voice, and I'm reinterpreting Bible stories. mostly in the Old Testament, although I think my most recent piece, which is perhaps the best thing I've done, is a 6-foot Annunciation. I suppose some people won't get my 21st century take on it.
Do you want to talk about that on the radio? Or should people just go see it? Tell us first of all about the person who modeled for the Annunciation.
Oh, Nikki is my muse. This child has such depth of soul. Michael Burt, an artist I collect and revere, had worked with her, and he said, "Ted, this kid has such soul in her, and it comes out." And I found that if I worked with her like she was an actress, that I could get what I wanted. And I said to her, "All right, here's the King James Version. The angel Gabriel or Archangel Michael come to the Virgin and say, God has looked on you with favor, and you are going to have his child." And she says, "How can that be? I'm a virgin." And he says, I'm quoting now from the King James, which is, along with Shakespeare, perhaps the best English ever written. He says, "God will come on you, and you will have Jesus." I put it to Nikki in 21st century language, and I asked her if at any time in her life she had a kind of sexual shock like that. And she thought for a long time. She nodded her head, yes. And I said, "All right, don't tell me." Then I taught her an acting exercise invented by Konstantin Stanislavski at the beginning of the 20th century called effective sense memory. And I led her signpost by signpost by signpost to that moment, and she felt it. And there it was on her face. And because she was so intuitive and smart, she was able to do that every day that she came to pose. And the pose came out of her. I didn't say, "Put your foot there, lift your arms this way." It all came out of her soul. And when I saw it, that was the piece.
So working with sculpture models as if they are actresses, that's probably an unusual thing, because most people don't have that director's training that you have.
Well, I don't know how unusual it is, but I've now narrowed my roster of models down to 3 ladies. They are all women with that sensitivity and intelligence, and they are all able to do what Nikki did. I just finished a piece which I expect to be in every Planned Parenthood organization in the world, of Colleen, who's one of my 3, nursing her baby. There was never, ever a happier mother than Colleen. Since she was 5 years old, all she wanted to be was a mommy. And the happiest moment of her life was when they put the baby on her breast and the baby began to nurse. And I saw that joy on her face when she was nursing her baby. And that's the piece I'm just finishing. It's terrific. I have yet to see a woman who doesn't just ooh and ah over it.
We're talking to artist Ted Flicker. And once again, his work is at Wade Wilson Art on Canyon Road here in Santa Fe. So talk about some of your other interpretations of Bible stories.
Uh-huh. Well,
there's one of them at Wade Wilson. The Two Wives of Adam.
Oh, that's fun. That's not really a Bible story. It's from my reading of the commentaries. In some of the commentaries, they say God made Lilith before Adam. Other commentaries say that Lilith was really Adam's first wife. I was thinking, what if God made Lilith when he was making the critters, because he made the critters before Adam? So what if she's the first draft? She's part human and part critter. So I made her half serpent. And I have this newborn 20-something who knows nothing,
namely
Eve. And I have Lilith holding the apple over her. And what she's doing is hipping this 20-something who knows nothing about life. What's good and what's bad. What's good is pleasure. What's bad is anything that gets in the way of pleasure. And by pleasure, of course, I mean anything sexual.
Now, that's an interesting interpretation of what's good and bad, because, of course, the apple is part of the sculpture, which comes from the tree of knowledge, and that kind of knowledge can be interpreted as wisdom.
Yeah. Tell me wisdom is not life is about pleasure. I mean, pleasure is defined in so many ways. The pleasure I get in my studio every day is about as deep a pleasure as I've ever had from anything in my life. How about the pleasure of an intellectual discovering a new theory? It's all kinds of pleasure.
And so, in your interpretation, wisdom always involves pleasure.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Hey, I can't help it. Some people say I'm a dirty old man because I work with naked girls all the time. But.
And you like that.
I love it. Come on, what's better than getting up in the morning and going into the studio and there's this gorgeous young naked thing? And none of them feel like they're objects.
Well, that's interesting, too, because there's certainly been this long-standing tradition of the male artist and the female model and the female as the muse, and it's...
No, the longest-standing tradition is in the Renaissance, the nude models were almost always prostitutes, and it up through the 19th century, it got maybe a level or two above prostitute, where they became the mistress of the painter. Rodin actually married his. But in the 20th century, from about mid-20th century on, basically when women began to discover that they were whole human beings, that it began to be not just a respectable thing to do, but it was an important artistic thing to do.
I mean, that's the interesting thing to me, is the woman taking kind of almost a co-equal and active role, as you talk about your models doing.
When I sign these pieces that these three ladies pose for, I put their name on it too, because I think they are a serious collaborative effort.
Now tell us about some of the other Bible stories, because they're not all naked women.
No. My favorite, and Wade Wilson is intending for this to go to an important museum, is I read the Book of Jay, which Harold J. Bloom and David Rosenberg wrote about 10, 12 years ago. The piece is called Jay, and it shows a woman, life-size, with a gold mask on her face in the style of Greek theater. The face is Moses. She is called Jay because she invented Yahweh. What? A woman invented Yahweh? She was a poet in the declining years of the reign of King Solomon. And the aristocrats in that time were heavily into literature. What they've discovered in the fragments of her poetry is that she was a poetess the equal of Homer or Shakespeare. And what she did was she researched about 1,500, 2,000 years worth of legend, folktale, song, ritual, and she wrote this epic poem called Genesis, Exodus, and Numbers. In other words, it was the first draft of the Old Testament.
Written by a woman.
Written by a woman. Well, when she died, here come the suits who've got a religion to run, and they're not going to let a woman be the author of the Bible. They gave it to this character they invented called Moses. And my piece is about that.
Now, is this a piece of scholarly research that's widely accepted?
Most of us have not heard
yes.
of Jay.
It's it has a lot to do with the archaeological studies in what Christians call the Holy Land and we call Israel. And in the 19th century, all of the archaeologists were looking to confirm the Bible, new or old. So it was distorted. And by the end of the 20th century, so many things have been discovered since mid-20th century. And when I say so many, I mean thousands of cuneiform tablets from Hammurabi on, things written on leather, scrolls hidden in bottles, you know. So much has been discovered that scholarship now can produce a book like this.
Right.
David Rosenberg is not only an important biblical scholar, he's a major poet. And he translated her first draft and did it in poetry.
And how do they know who she was?
They have all those tablets, they have records, they have corroborating tablets from witnesses, from contemporaries. It's utterly and the book, if you haven't read it, it'll change your life.
Say the name of it again for our listeners.
The Book of Jay by Harold J. Bloom. And, you know, he's America's intellectual. And David Rosenberg. It's on Amazon. It's in paperback. I keep buying them and giving them to people.
And people are responding to it the way you did, or in other words, with the same enthusiasm.
Everybody I've given it to, yeah.
Very interesting. We're talking to artist Ted Flicker. So, do you miss movie making at all?
Yeah, about as much as I miss sticking my hand in the garbage disposal.
There we have it.
Yeah.
In terms of sculpture, you're not only telling stories and interacting with the most important people in your life, you're also really working with some very interesting materials, some of them the most traditional sculptural materials ever, like bronze and stone, and some of them these new materials like the polymers you were
yeah.
talking about.
Well, that's the polymer's wonderful. It's sort of the same process as lost wax bronze.
What is lost wax bronze?
Well, you make a mold of the original sculpture.
So you make a sculpture out of?
Let's say I make a sculpture out of clay.
Right.
That's what I do almost all the time, although now I'm starting in wax. But, and then the mold maker comes in and sprays on a very, very thin coat of silica rubber. And it's called a print coat. That will pick up my fingerprints. That dries for 24 hours. Another coat is put on. 24 hours later, he then trowels on a thick coat of rubber, about a quarter of an inch thick. And then he encases the whole thing in plaster because the rubber won't be able to support the wax you're going to make in it. It needs the plaster walls. So then you split it in half and you paint in wax the thickness of what you want the bronze to be. And then you take the mold off, and there is a positive that looks just like the original.
Uh-huh.
You may have to clean up a few air bubbles or a seam line or something. And then that is dipped into a catalyst and then held over a tank of silica, very fine silica, which is blown on it, until that is about a quarter of an inch thick. That dries for a week. And then it's put into an oven and heated to 2,000 degrees. The wax, now losing itself, melts out of it and is gone. And while it's still hot, you pour in the bronze at about 2,000 degrees. Meanwhile, the silica has turned into ceramic. So when it all cools, they got to hammer off the ceramic and then sandblast it to clean it. It's a complicated process. Well, the polymer, I make the mold the same way. And then I pour in. This is a modern material that was designed for architectural ornamentation on buildings in cities with sulfuric air. And it will live outside almost as long as bronze. Certainly longer than me. And I can do those in my studio. My assistant does them. And they're out in my sculpture garden. I got a piece of Paul Moore's been out there 16 years.
Of that material, of the polymer.
And you know what? It costs about 1% of bronze.
Oh, my goodness.
Big.
And so is that what people are using, for example, who are now in art school learning those techniques?
I don't know. It makes me crazy. I keep meeting sculptors, and I tell them about it. I say, you know, it gives you a chance to make large pieces and display them outside, and they still don't do it. Although I had a very a successful Indian sculptor. She came to me and wanted to know about it, and I showed her, and she was thrilled, and she's doing it a lot now.
Very interesting. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, when you decide you're going to make a bronze, you better have a piece you're really crazy about. It's not it's not something that you're going to experiment. Well, let's see how it comes out.
Right. You know, I just did a portrait, a double portrait of Joe and Valerie Plame Wilson. I'm going to cast two polymers, and I'm hoping, and Jill Udall said she's going to really try and make it happen. Probably only will happen if Obama gets reelected, because I think they're major American heroes, and they should be in bronze in Washington. I'm not saying, okay, I want them on a horse in Lafayette Park, but they should be in Washington, and I want them in the National Portrait Gallery.
We're talking to Ted Flicker. Now, you are going to be part of the reception that's happening tonight at Wade Wilson Art on 409 Canyon Road, and it's a nice show with a lot of other artists in the show with you. And Wade Wilson is based in Houston and has a new gallery here in Santa Fe. Is that correct?
Yeah. He has a very successful gallery in Houston. And he places a lot of his artist's work in museums. And he decided to open one on Canyon Road.
So are you hoping to get your work into museums as well?
Oh, please. I certainly want Jay. I'd like Jay in an important Jewish museum, but an important art museum will be okay. The piece is really part of me, and so I'm serious about it.
And meanwhile, here in Santa Fe, people will have a chance to see your work for a while to come.
So when this show comes down in about a week and a half, Wade tells me he's going to put my 6-foot Annunciation in the courtyard in front of his gallery. I think it's a chancy thing to do. It could offend some very serious religious people, and I hope nobody defaces it or anything.
I hope so, too. Ted Flicker, it's wonderful to have you back on the air, and we look forward to seeing you tonight and seeing more of your sculpture in the future.
Oh, Mary Charlotte, thank you for having me, kid.
So in this segment, we'll be talking about The Jungle Book and Little Shop of Horrors, both of which are being presented by Santa Fe Performing Arts and City Different Players. I'd like to introduce Megan Burns, director, and Brandon Lucero and Sierra McDowell Nardine, actors in Little Shop of Horrors. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
So what's the play all about?
Who wants to take this one?
Sierra does.
It's basically just about a flower shop on Skid Row, and Seymour is kind of like a nerdy kid, well, guy, I guess.
Played by Brandon right here.
Yeah, Brandon. And he discovers this new plant that's kind of like a Venus flytrap, and he finds out that the plant feeds on blood of humans, so that's like a main part of it.
And we won't give away the whole thing, but so it's kind of a horror show.
Yeah.
Is it scary?
In some ways it can be really scary, because I feed the plants people parts.
Indeed. And so this is a production, Megan, that you're directing, and you're working with young people a lot now in these theater productions.
Yes, I am. Little Shop of Horrors is being presented by the Teen Ensemble. So this age group is 13 to 18. Our oldest member is probably only 16. It's a really good group. I think there's 12 actors. It's a musical. There's lots of really great songs. It's kind of like a 60s era of music, so I really like the music. I think it's really good. Some really good dancers in the group. It's one of my favorite musicals. It's such a great show.
What are your challenges is it like directing a high school musical for you because you're working with that age group?
This one has been really amazing for me because there's so much talent in the group that I've really been able to sort of sit back and really just do my job working with individual actors on scenes or, you know, worry about costumes or talk with the musical director about certain things. And the actors themselves are coming to the table with so much already prepared. This is based on a movie, and so they've been able to, I think, do a lot of homework watching it at home or, you know, looking up YouTube videos. So there's really good characters that are already out there that they can base their own, you know, characters on. But no, I feel like I'm working with total professionals who are just coming in and they're like got their lines memorized and their songs memorized, and it's really great.
Did you both spend a lot of time watching the movie?
I haven't seen the movie, so I just kind of do my own thing.
What about you, Sierra?
I've seen it a couple times, and I've kind of tried to, like, do some of the things that Audrey does in the movie, but, like, make it my own at the same time.
Do you both have quite a bit of acting experience already?
Yeah, we've actually both been with Santa Fe Performing Arts for a really long time.
Have you sung before on stage?
No.
This is Brandon's first debut as a lead musical actor, and is doing such an amazing job.
Yeah.
So proud of both of them.
Excellent. Well, it's it's Little Shop of Horrors, and it's this weekend and next weekend at 7 o'clock, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and it's at the Armory for the Arts, which is where you always do your plays.
Yes.
Good. Well, for more information, people can call 984-1370. Brandon Lucero and Sierra McDowell Nardine, thank you for being with us. And Megan Burns, stick around, because we're going to be talking about The Jungle Book in just a moment. And Megan Burns continues to join us, and we are joined by Catherine Mark, who is the director of The Jungle Book, which is opening tonight at 7 in the evening and then goes on through this and next weekend. Matinees, welcome.
Thank you.
So this is not a musical. This is The Jungle Book, taken from Kipling's The Jungle Book.
Yes, it's from his work. And the kids are doing great. They haven't wanted to defer to the musical version. And we've been having a wonderful time with developing characters of the story. Shere Khan and Mowgli and Bagheera, Baloo and Ka. The kids are doing fabulously.
Now, what age group are you working with?
I'm working with 6 to 12-year-olds. And some of the children have never been on stage before, and several of them are some of our seasoned actors in our City Different Players troupe who will go on in the next year or two to graduate to our City Different, our teen ensemble, and go and do the older kids' work.
Which is what you, Megan, are directing and working with.
Exactly.
Now, do you have, Megan, a role in this? I mean, are you doing anything for The Jungle Book?
I have been backstage occasionally letting Catherine know what I've done in certain circumstances.
And she's serving as a mentor for me as well.
Right.
A great coach and mentor.
I've worked with that age group for probably 6 years now. So, but I actually haven't seen it yet. I'm excited to see it this Thursday.
What are the challenges of working with kids that age?
Well, many of them have never been on the stage before. So the challenge is introducing them to the form and helping them understand how, as a performing art, that they are not just in dialogue, for example, with their partners in the scene, but they are performing for an audience. So teaching them how to project their voices, how to face out towards the audience and stay in character at the same time, all of those things are new for a lot of our actors, especially the young ones. There are a few who are 6 and 7 years old.
And what happens when they get nervous?
So far, they've all really held it together, and they're excited rather than nervous. So we have not had an audience per se yet, and so I'm sure that there will be some last-minute nerves that will come up on opening night. But we've talked about some of the techniques to calm those nerves, to breathe, to slow down, to stay in character, and relax.
This is really, I mean, there are so many, everybody is always talking about cuts in education and arts programs getting cut and things like that. And I guess you guys are really stepping in where maybe the schools don't have funding to do that kind of theater.
Yes. And Santa Fe Performing Arts also has an artist in residence program and a teacher training program that goes into the public schools as well. In some cases, they're grant funded. In other cases, they're just free outreach programs to the schools. But those are not as frequent as they used to be. And so this is a program that has been going on for, well, we're closing in on our 25th year. So parents and families of this community have known that Santa Fe Performing Arts offers this kind of education and programming throughout the school year and the summers. And it's a tribute to being a member of the community that we've been in existence for as long as we have. And yes, we do try to fill that hole that we see in the cuts that are happening in education in the schools.
Do young people have to audition to become part of this play, or is there a place for everybody?
There is a place for everybody. It's not an audition-based program. We accept students who have had no experience, and we accept seasoned actors. It's a training program. That's our goal, is for them to learn the craft and for them to have a good time and for them to have an experience performing for other people.
So it's The Jungle Book, Santa Fe Performing Arts, and Thursday, July 19th at 7 in the evening, and then Saturday and Sunday, the 21st and 22nd, and then the 28th and 29th at 2 in the afternoon, matinee, and then in some evenings there will also be the Little Shop of Horrors, so it's lots of fun for the whole family, all ages, and lots going on at the Armory for the Arts.
Absolutely, the double bill. So 2 o'clock matinee Jungle Book and evening performances of Little Shop of Horrors on the weekends, Saturdays and Sundays.
Tickets are highly affordable, and you can call 984-1370 for more information. Catherine, Mark, and Megan Burns, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Robert Knott. He is...
Never mind. He is what? He is Robert Knott.
Well, he's the writer, co-writer, and co-director of yet another crazy slapstick play at Warehouse 21 that opens tonight, co-written and co-directed by Matt Sanford, called The Persecution and Assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand by members of Cosmo Martin's theater troupe. And it's opening tonight and running through the 29th of July. And Chloe Siegman is here with us. She's an actress in this play. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
So the genesis of the madness, Robert.
Loosely based on history, Archduke Franz Ferdinand was in fact assassinated when he took a wrong turn on a bridge called Latin Bridge on his way to the theater by a member of the Black Hand, which was an underground group that was unhappy with his rule over in Austria-Hungary, thereby launching the world into World War I. And I'm really simplifying things. In this case, we have an American melodrama troupe touring Europe which inadvertently gets involved with it because two of the actors turn out to be members of the Black Hand, and they're orchestrating his play called Wrong Turn at Latin Bridge into an attempt to lure the Archduke to the theater and assassinate him. Chloe plays one of the three actors in the troupe, Mel. Why she has a male name and is played by a woman is not even
Mel could be short for Melanie.
It could be. So you're right. That's a good way to look at it.
Or Melody, yeah. Or Mel.
Oh, I like that. Which one is it?
It's Melanie.
Okay.
Ooh, absolutely. Nice.
See?
Good. And it's her first year with us. She's the youngest of our 14 to 27-year-old thespians. This is my 10th show there, and I love working with them all. And it's her first time around, and somehow or other she stayed with us.
It's crazy, but it's wonderful, and it's so much fun, and I love the form. It's my first time working in this form of theater or anything even close to it.
What form of theater? What do you mean?
Like the slapstick comedy.
Slapstick comedy.
And, yes.
Now, this is, of course, something which our dear Robert Knott specializes in. You, Chloe, have been going to the New Mexico School for the Arts and studying theater there, at least for your freshman year.
Right, yes.
And what kind of theater were you doing over there?
It was much more conventional, I would say. It was definitely more, like, set on a timeline and do this now and stay to the timeline. And this has been... less of that and more more craziness.
More wild and wacky. I'm so surprised.
No, I know you're surprised. Of course you're surprised. It's my 10th show there. It's been a lot of fun doing these. And it's my 5th with Matt Sanford, who's a really good actor, writer, director. And we've got a returning troupe of some people you know, like Ryan Koshevar, Christina V. Hill. And then we've got some newcomers like Matt Pewitt and Chloe and Matthew Montoya. So... it's just another crazy, wild thing. We try to do some things differently. We just never know how it's going to play. We have sword fights. We have chases.
Have you ever done a play that didn't have a sword fight in it?
I've never directed anything other than comedy. I've certainly acted in plays that don't have a sword fight.
No, I mean written. The ones that you've written of these Warehouse 21
no,
plays.
Well, we started the sword fights 4 years ago, and they've become, I don't know, we've become addicted to them to the point where the actors actually said, you've got to add sword fights. So, and there's some referential lines in the play about that. So yes, there are sword fights and chases and bops on the head and intrigue and a Trans-Serbian Express and a scarecrow and
right.
You either like them or you don't, and people figure it out pretty quickly when they come to them.
and you know, your influence of slapstick movies, little bit of Three Stooges, kind of New York humor, alliteration.
Bad puns, good puns.
Really bad
double
puns.
Double entendres.
Is there such thing as a good pun?
There
Maybe.
Are good puns, especially when I come on your show on Friday mornings.
Yeah, we hope to have you back soon.
I'm
going to
come
days.
In August, aren't I?
I think you are.
Okay, good. Send me an invite. Send me some flowers.
I invite you right now.
Try to seduce me and I'll come over.
It's not hard. No, just kidding.
So, yeah, we're running for 2 weekends at Warehouse. It's Pay What You Wish Thursdays. Can't name prices otherwise, but it's very affordable.
Very affordable indeed.
Warehouse 21's by the railroad track, 1614 Paseo de Peralta. You got any other thoughts, lady, Miss Chloe?
I think that's about it. I think you about covered it.
Good.
Warehouse 21 continues to be a place where you get to do this kind of work and where, although it's not just young people really get to get experience in theater and in the arts.
It's still a really vibrant, much larger facility than it was in the old days when it was an old garage. And they have so many different things from computer classes to silk screening to a fashion studio. More and more theater groups are coming there, more and more young people, which is really how it should be. I mean, I'm talking to some of the younger actors about letting them sort of take over the summer program there, because it really should be something driven by them. And it has expanded to include like 20 and 25-somethings in there, in the group. Like I said, I think our oldest actor is 27. Chloe's 14. And that's organically grown out of the days when they were all teenagers, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. And you can find just about anything there. There's concerts on the weekend. There's mixed media events. There's art gallery, photo gallery shows up hanging up there. Ana Gallegos Reinhardt is still running. I think she's a wonderful woman. They're always in need of volunteers. They're always in need of any support people can give them. You can go on the website. Pretty easy to find, www.warehouse21. And swing by if you haven't visited. You know, you're always welcome to pop in there.
And especially tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 7:30, Sunday at 4 in the afternoon, this weekend and next weekend through the 29th of July.
That's right. And the 4 p.m. matinees have really been working out for us. We're not the only theater troupe to try that, and people really like them.
I like the 4 p.m. matinee. You get to have your Sunday.
You get to have your Sunday. You can go take a walk. Then you're out in time, 6 o'clock for dinner. So
exactly.
It's really nice. So.
Well, Robert Knott and Chloe Siegman are in The Persecution and Assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand by members of Cosmo Martin's theater troupe. And actually, Robert Knott isn't in it, but he's co-writer and co-director along with Matt Sanford. Somebody should just separate the two of you at some point.
That's
probably
never
going to happen.
We've written a very funny play, I'll tell you real quickly, in which we act as father and son. We haven't produced yet.
Uh-oh.
I think it's going to be hilarious.
Oh, my.
So
that's
thanks.
Terrifying.
Terrifying. Thanks, Lee. That means a lot to me.
Thanks, Bill,
for being
here.
I'll see you in August.
Okay.
Come on and play.
Wonderful.
Bye.
Bye.